So Epiphany continued. This is the last Epiphany message of the season, because next week is the Spiritual Life Conference. And then after that, we're going to be talking about the table. And there's going to be a lot of connection points between Epiphany and the table. But we're going to be doing a series as we lead into Lent, talking about the Lord's Supper, about communion, and about what that represents. But that is after the Spiritual Life Conference. So yeah, as I mentioned last week, it's not Epiphany proper as far as the calendar that we're following, but we've extended a little bit to talk about the way Jesus is revealed to us as Messiah, as the Christ. And we talked about this in his birth, in his nativity, and then as he was presented to the Magi, which extends to us all in baptism, and then last week in water to wine. And then today we're going to be talking about his transfiguration, about when he was changed, and with radiant lights on that mountain. Transfiguration is one of those kind of words that has become basically religious language. We don't use it in other contexts for the most part. If you Google transfiguration, then it's all religious things that come up, and that comes from the Latin word transfigura, and that is why we use that term, because that means to change. Good. So I mentioned also last week that John goes about the revelation of Christ's glory in a different manner, that he does this as a series of things, as a series of revelations. But then it's the Transfiguration and then the Synoptic Gospels in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which talk about Christ's glory being revealed in this one awesome, extraordinary moment with Peter, James, and John on that mountaintop. These are experiences where heaven and earth are closer together than, let's say, than they appear to be. These are these thin places where heaven breaks into earth and changes things. And just it's an opportunity of miracles, an opportunity of a glimpse of glory, a glimpse into heaven, a glimpse to who God is. So I'd like to read Matthew 17, 1-13. If you can find on page 1492 in your pew Bibles. And it's kind of, I picked Matthew for a similar reason as last week, and that's been, we've been talking about Matthew kind of framed by the Magi being the only recorded in Matthew. But I'm going to bring in some of the other Gospels, Luke and Mark, as we talk about this. And it's interesting how they describe the events, because as often happens with miraculous, exciting, crazy events, you don't quite remember them exactly the same way, because there's too much going on, too much happening. And so you remember this point, you remember that point. And it's like when there's an accident and the police ask for an account of those things. And somebody said, well, I heard the honk and then the screech. But then somebody might hear say, well, no, I heard the screech and then the honk. And those are the type of things that happen when there's flash of a moment type of miraculous events. So let's read Matthew 17, 1-13 together. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and led them up a high mountain to be alone. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed so that his face shone like the sun and his clothes became as white as light. Suddenly, Moses and Elijah appeared and began talking with Jesus. Peter exclaimed, Lord, it's wonderful for us to be here. If you want, I'll make three shelters as memorials, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. But even as he spoke, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my dearly loved son, who brings me great joy. Listen to him. The disciples were terrified and fell face down on the ground. Then Jesus came over and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. And when they looked up, Moses and Elijah were gone, and they saw only Jesus. As they went back down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Then his disciples asked him, Why do the teachers of the religious law insist that Elijah must return before the Messiah comes? Jesus replied, Elijah is indeed coming first to get everything ready, but I tell you, Elijah has already come. But he wasn't recognized, and they chose to abuse him. And in the same way, they will also make the Son of Man suffer. Then the disciples realized he was talking about John the Baptist. So the 6 days later reference is 6 days after Jesus predicts his own death. And this kind of sets the context with which the transfiguration happens. This miraculous moment on the mountaintop where the voice of Yahweh, the voice of God, speaks. It's kind of around this time where Peter has a really good experience and then a really bad experience, which is, we often characterize Peter as such. Peter makes this confession that Jesus is the Messiah, and then a couple breaths later, Peter's rebuked by Jesus for saying that Jesus himself will not die, that these events will not happen. As I mentioned, the other Gospels tell a little bit of a different, or have different aspects that they highlight in the story, and they're just minor points, and it's what happens when miraculous things take place. So, for example, Luke tells us that Jesus was praying when this happened, that he went up to the mountain to pray, and then these miraculous things happen. He also tells us that Peter and those with him, being James and John, were asleep when this first happened, but then they were fully awake to see Jesus' glory. And in Peter's tent building statement, when he says, let's build some tents to memorialize this, we also get the explanation that he didn't know what he was saying. And we have, in Matthew, it just skips right past that statement of tent building. Mark explains that Peter was terrified, and that's why he didn't know what he was saying. And it's in Mark 9:6, we have an interesting way the translation comes out, and it says he didn't know how to respond, and the Greek word is the one that's often used to answering in a conversation, like he said, and then he answered. And it's for Peter, he doesn't have any category with which to filter this experience. It's, he can't process it, he doesn't know how to respond to it. This is just too miraculous, too marvelous to comprehend. So he says this thing because he just can't process it, he can't deal with it, he can't handle it. As I mentioned, Peter had a good day, and then he had a bad one. And the first one, it was mentioned that he would be the rock on which Christ would build his church as he confessed that Jesus is Messiah. And then right after, he has the "get away from me, Satan," rebuked by Jesus for saying that Jesus' death wouldn't come. And then it's this experience, the 6 days later with James and John, with this the wonder. Now, mountains and mountaintops are an important Old Testament image and comes out throughout the Old Testament. And you have the major central image, and that's on Mount Sinai, when God revealed himself to Moses. And we have Moses going up and God giving the law to Moses, and the law being here the connection point of the relationship between God and his people, the God who just brought them out of Egypt, who just rescued them. We also have Mount Horeb, which is a different name for Sinai, which is used more predominantly in Deuteronomy. And it's when Elijah, he flees, and he goes up to this mountain, and he has this experience with God as he doesn't see him in these loud and crazy things, but hears him, sees him, understands him in the still, small voice. The mountain of God, and this is often understood as the dwelling place of God, where God dwelt on Mount Sinai. And these experiences, they're called theophanies. They're experiences where God reveals himself, which is what the word means, a God revelation, a God experience, where heaven and earth are pulled apart and you're able to see God, see into heaven. So what were Peter, James, and John expecting as they make this journey? As Jesus says, "Hey, guys, come with me there. Come up this mountain." Were they expecting a theophany? Were they expecting to see something this miraculous, this earth-shattering? Or were they just expecting a quiet few moments with Jesus where they're just going to hang out, maybe sit in silence? Was Peter still thinking about his good day and his bad day as they went up to the mountain? The story tells us nothing of this journey. We don't know if it was an easy walk or a hard walk. If it was a hard walk, it would explain why they had fallen asleep, as mentioned in the Gospel of Luke. Now, I remember one walk I took up a mountain is when we were living in Germany. We went down, as many Germans do, to Italy, and we were staying in Tuscany. And the people we're going with, the husband, he was an avid hiker and walker, and he loved this, and he said, "We need to go hike up a mountain." And we said, "All right, but make it an easy one." And it was a tough walk. It was narrow, it was hot, it was very hot. So he was one of those rec leadership guys, as a shout out to Miriam, as we call the venture program from Tyndale. But he knew where we were going. We were just following after him. And so after a little while, it wasn't in the first couple minutes, but it was after seemingly hours, we started to say, well, how much further do we have to go? How much longer? And he always said, just about 30 more minutes. And this became a pattern for our whole walk. Oh, yeah, just about 30 more minutes. So when we got to the summit, or at least what we thought was the summit, we were very proud of ourselves. We're looking out. We're taking pictures. We're saying, great, we made it. And then he pipes up and says, well, actually, the summit's over there. And we're like, well, how long is that going to take us? And he said, 30 more minutes. And he said, nope, we're going back down. So the text doesn't give us any of that. It doesn't tell us about the journey, about that process. The text goes right to what happened. Jesus is transfigured. And in Matthew and Mark, this word is metamorphosis, the Greek word that we get for metamorphosis. It sounds and spelled virtually identical. And his appearance has changed. And what does this mean? It says that he exceedingly bright light and color of radiant light, like the sun. Now, I already mentioned Moses' mountain encounter when God reveals himself to Moses. And we have in Exodus 33 where Moses asks God to pass in front of him. And God says, you know what? I will pass in front of you, but I'll only show you I marked out not to say show him his behind, because I was like, show him his back. And I had that in my mind. Don't say that. And then when you focus on something, you end up, ugh. So he says, I'll show you my back. And then in this miraculous thing, this amazing thing, Moses falls face down, just like the disciples did. And I'd like to read this text because it is the controlling metaphor, the image that's in the background here. And that's Exodus. This is when Moses comes down after the mountain, after this miraculous experience, and what happens in that experience to Moses. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, carrying the two stone tablets inscribed with the terms of the covenant, he wasn't aware that his face had become radiant because he had spoken to the Lord. So when Aaron and the people of Israel saw the radiance of Moses' face, they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called out to them and asked Aaron and all the leaders of the community to come over, and he talked with them. Then all the people of Israel approached him, and Moses gave them all the instructions the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking with them, he covered his face with a veil. But whenever he went into the tent of meeting to speak with the Lord, he would remove the veil until he came out again. Then he would give the people whatever instructions the Lord had given him, and the people of Israel would see the radiant glow of his face. So he would put the veil over his face until he returned to speak with the Lord. These images and experience are in the background of this mountain experience, with this change in Moses' face that happened to the people that they can't deal with. Moses doesn't realize it has happened, but the people can't deal with this brilliance, this beautiful light that's radiating from his face. We see this happens to Jesus on the mountain. It's fitting that Moses and Elijah are the ones who appear, the ones who appear in this moment of theophany where God pulls back the veil. They are the two prophets, and I mean this literally, who had seen the most of the Lord. We have this with Moses and the Horeb story with Elijah that I mentioned, where the Lord reveals himself in a miraculous, intense way. In this mountaintop experience with Peter, James, and John, Jesus is revealed as the Lord's Son, as the Messiah, and Moses and Elijah are there. Now Luke adds the explanation that Moses and Elijah and Jesus were talking about his coming death, and that's the framework with which the revelation happens. Now Peter, as I mentioned, says something with no ability to process the event, no ability to understand what's going on. And I'm going to comment about that in a second. But first I want to talk about the cloud of God. And that is another image from Exodus, this cloud of God, this weighty presence of God as he reveals himself, as he comes down. And that's in Exodus 24, 15 to 18. And this is when Moses first ascended to the mountain, a little bit earlier than the passage we read. Then Moses climbed up the mountain, and the cloud covered it. And the glory of the Lord settled down on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses from inside the cloud. To the Israelites at the foot of the mountain, the glory of the Lord appeared at the summit like a consuming fire. Then Moses disappeared into the cloud as he climbed higher up the mountain. He remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. With Peter, James, and John in this passage in Matthew, it's this voice calling out, and it's not just heard by Moses, it's not just heard by one person, it's not just heard by Jesus. Peter, James, and John hear this voice, and what they hear spoken is, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him." This is a confirmation of who Jesus is, a confirmation of his messiahship. Jesus is the one who speaks God's words and has authority. This is God's representative. This is now God with us, God who has come down, God who has come down off the mountain. And this is how Peter refers to this experience later on in the letter of 2 Peter. For Peter, James, and John, this experience, if it wasn't already too much, is way beyond too much now. They fall face down. And I get a sense that it's better to say they collapse just completely at this moment where they hear the voice of Yahweh speaking to them. And then Jesus comes and says to them, and I imagine it to be a soft little touch, a soft little quietness. And he says, "Get up. Do not be afraid. Do not fear. Stop fearing. There's no need for fear anymore." And then they descend down the mountain, and they're told on the way not to tell anyone until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. They ask this question about Elijah coming first, and then they draw the connection to John the Baptist. And Jesus frames this answer in the context of the fact that his death is coming, that the cross is before him. And this is where the story is going. This is where the story has been going, is to the cross, where Jesus is fully revealed. The full presence of God is then revealed in that. So let's return just quickly to Peter's tent making. He says, "Lord, it's good that we are here. If you wish, I will make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." Now, the idea of tent here is dwelling places. It's used throughout the Old Testament, the Shekinah, the tabernacle. This is the word that's used here. And it's the idea of building something to commemorate a theophany, to commemorate an experience where God has spoken to a person, is fairly common when you look at the ancestors. You have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and each one of them build an altar to commemorate a theophany, to commemorate God's voice being spoken to them. So the concept fits here with Peter. It's not the craziest thing that he thinks about when he thinks about the Old Testament story and altar building to commemorate these type of experiences. Say, "Wow, heaven's been open. Let's commemorate this experience. Like, let's put a remembrance here." And Rob talked about this last year on this Sunday that marks the 1 year here. And he says, you talked about how you can't stay there. This isn't the point to stay on the mountaintop. It isn't to put something there that then you can come back to and you can just say, "Oh, this is where the experience happened." This is not the point of Jesus being revealed as the very presence of God, as God's chosen Son, as the Messiah. They're supposed to move out of the reality of this new experience and this, with a fuller understanding and a fuller experience about who God is and who Jesus is, specifically from this moment on as God. God is not on that mountain. God is coming down with them. He's breaking into the world and revealed Jesus. The theophany hasn't ended. This moment of revelation hasn't ended. It's the beginning. The revelation of God is descending with you, telling you not to fear. As you think about our journey, our life, the times where we go up the mountain, whether it's a tough climb or not, and our experiences with God, sometimes we have these experiences which are beyond our ability to understand. God reveals himself to us. He draws us in. He gives us a word through his Spirit, and he reveals himself to us in a special way, a way that we can then point to. Perhaps it's in answered prayer. Perhaps it's in a moment of connection with someone in worship or whatever it is. It's a moment where you just sense God's presence. You sense you're in a thin place, where you have a theophany, where heaven and earth are touching and you're there, and you experience it. And you have it, it's wonderful. And you perhaps make a signpost, a tent, where you can commemorate, where you can remember those incidents in the past. And those are not bad things. It's not bad to remember those experiences. It's not bad to put those as markers of God's faithfulness in the trajectory of your journey. I was actually talking to someone after the morning service today where they were talking about an experience that they were in where they had to trust God. And I said, yeah, well, I remember when I was in a similar circumstance and God was faithful in this and this and this. And often I pull out these moments in my prayer time where I'm expecting God to answer. I'm saying, God, like you did here, do those experiences again. So we're just like Peter. We want to mark the moments, and that's okay. But as we walk down the metaphorical mountain of God, as we walk down these moments of revelation where God is especially close to us, where we feel God's presence, God's security, God's safety, we have to remember that He is not stuck on that mountain. He's not stuck in just those isolated moments of revelation, those isolated moments where we feel He's revealed Himself especially to us. He is God with us. He is God continually with us. He's God in the dark places, in the moments of grace. He's in all those moments. He's coming down the mountain with us. Even if we feel like we're coming down the mountain into a valley, He is with us in those situations. Perhaps we feel like we're on the mountaintop, or we feel like we've just had one of those experiences. And it's good to remember those, to hold fast to them in the moments where we feel like we're not there. And in all these moments, in all these situations, Jesus speaks those words to us. He speaks the words, do not fear. Do not fear. Because He is with us. His promise is stay fast. It's actually interesting when you look at the last words that Jesus gives to us in the Gospel of Matthew. And He says, and be sure of this, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Those words hold fast in the moments of revelation, the moments of going up and coming down the mountain. He's with us continually and always. If you remember the end of Matthew, that whole passage is set in the context of sending us out. Jesus came and told His disciples, I have been given all authority in heaven and earth. Therefore, go and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I have given you. And be sure of this, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Because as Jesus went up the mountain with Peter, James, and John, and they experienced His glory, they came down and they were charged to not tell about this until after Jesus rose from the dead, which implies that they were supposed to celebrate this and tell about this after He was raised from the dead. That is the charge. And Paul picks up on the imagery of Moses and the imagery, the same controlling images in the background when he says, we are supposed to reflect the images of Christ's glory. We're supposed to reflect that brilliant light that Peter, James, and John saw on the mountain. So as I'm sure you're familiar, I often talk about this double call to us to experience God's presence, to experience a mountaintop theophany, to experience His words to us, His revelation of His glory. But at the same time, as we're changed by that image, as we see His light, that we're supposed to then take that in ourselves, in our lives, and push that forward, push that out, and reflect that glory in all situations. Because that's the double call of the New Testament. It's a call to come in and experience Christ, experience His love, experience His revelation to us as Messiah. But it's also that call to push us out and to reveal His light to the world and to the situations we find ourselves. To call people to go up to the mountaintop, to find the intense presence of God, to find that light. The table is an opportunity to experience a thin place between heaven and earth, to experience a theophany, to experience Christ's presence. Talking recently about could doing it every week become a ritual with the table, and I've been thinking about that a little bit, and even though this is in the overall context of different traditions and different experiences. And the thing about the doing anything regularly, it has the possibility of becoming a ritual, becoming just a form that you say, all right, then this is the next step. This is, I do this, and then I go sit down and I sing. But the table is one of those opportunities to come up the mountain, to find the thin place, to take off a piece of the bread and have nourishment from Christ's body. It's come and have the opportunity to take, as we dip it in the cup, a piece of his blood and allow that to nourish us and sustain us and cleanse us and give us hope. This is an opportunity to come into his presence and be changed by that and then go out into the world to change it. It's the opportunity to experience a thin place. So I challenge you today to come into the presence of God as we come to the table, to come and experience a thin place, to experience a mountaintop experience where you experience God anew and afresh. We do it every week because it gives us the sustenance, it gives us the strength, the ability to live out faithfully in the week as we come together. We allow ourselves to be drawn in together to his presence, to his glory and the revelation of that. So come and be nourished, be refreshed, be challenged by an encounter with the living God.